Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning into episode 140 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. About 140 is the maximum number of characters you can tweet to at Infectious Myth or anywhere. And according to the Bible, Job lived 240 years, and so now has The Infectious Myth lived 240 episodes. You can email me at david.crowe, that's crowe with an e, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM, or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone using the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. And this week, the first person who writes in and indicates an interest and also includes your mailing address will get a copy of Alison Wolfe's book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. She was a previous guest on the show. I'm sad to report that a former guest, Liam Sheff, recently passed away. You can hear him on episode 54, talking about love, sex, politics, and the future of the planet. Ironically, he died because of health problems resulting from a botched medical procedure. He was one of the most independent people I knew, but even when we disagreed, I knew that his opinions and positions were genuine and he really cared. He just didn't care what you thought about him. His biggest victory was uncovering the truth about the Incarnation Children's Center in New York. What seemed like a beautiful charity was actually a money-making operation using HIV-positive infants as guinea pigs, hence the name of the BBC documentary, Guinea Pig Kids. They were mostly poor and colored. If they resisted, they got a tube in their stomach for the AIDS drugs. If their guardians resisted, they lost guardianship. It was truly one of the most horrific medical abuses I've ever heard of. Thanks, Liam. James Trainham is a private consultant, retired from the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. after 17 years of service. He has more recently worked for the Innocence Project, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and several defense lawyers. He was the Violent Crimes Case Review Project Director from 2000 to 2010. He received the Marymount University Forensic Psychology Program Award in Ethics and Law Enforcement in 2005, and the Innocence Network's Champion of Justice Award in 2009. He's written several articles on interrogations and also on innocence commissions, which review alleged wrongful conviction cases. He's been interviewed on the topic of interrogation and false confessions by The New Yorker, The New York Times, National Public Radio, among others, and soon, The Infectious Myth. He is quoted in the American Psychological Association's white paper on false confessions and has been an invited speaker many times at conferences and such. He's the author of the 2016 book, How the Police Generate False Confessions, An Inside Look at the Interrogation Room. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with me today. What is the impact of a confession, regardless of whether it's true or false, on a jury?
Oh my God, it's about the most overwhelming evidence that you can have. They've done numerous studies, and actually not only experiments, but just looking at cases in real life. And even when the confession is totally outrageous, even when there's overwhelming evidence to the contrary, people typically will believe a confession over anything else. A great example in the U.S. is this case involving four sailors down in Norfolk, Virginia, mm-hmm. who all four confessed to a murder. And yet, even after the police found the real suspect who confessed to doing it alone, and it was his DNA who was found on the scene, these guys still could not get exonerated for years until just recently.
Wow, and that's four confessions. So it's not just...
Right, yeah. Well, you know, one thing is people kind of look at that case and go, well, maybe one false confession is possible, but how could we get four? And it's... confessions like that are not that uncommon, where you have several people confess to the same crime. And it's because one confession feeds the other confession, feeds the other confession. And law enforcement is able to go into the second interrogation and say, hey, look, this guy just confessed and put you in it, and use that as leverage to get the second person to confess.
You've talked about something called contamination. Is this what you're referring to, where the interview is contaminated by the insertion of information that the person being interrogated didn't know before?
Yes, because, you know, one of the things that law enforcement likes to say is, yeah, okay, maybe we were a little coercive in our interrogation tactics, but that doesn't mean that the confession is false. Look at the details. He knows all these details about the crime. How could he have gotten those details unless he was there? And the way they can get those details is during the interrogation process, during very sloppy interview practices, we unintentionally give that person the details, not all at once typically, but in little bits and pieces. And that way the person, with the help of the detective, is able to structure a narrative that can be very, very believable.
I mean, you talk about the dynamic where the person being interrogated wants to please the investigator or sees pleasing the investigator as a way to get out of a probably a pretty uncomfortable situation, hours and hours of being sat in a chair and talked to in not a very pleasant way.
Well, it doesn't have to be all that unpleasant. Actually, I got a confession, a false confession myself, and that's how I started to study this. I wanted to understand what happened because I'm not somebody who yells and screams. I'm not mm-hmm. somebody who makes a lot of threats and all that sort of thing. I was more like a social worker type.
Right.
But the way that interrogations are structured here in the U.S., the way that we're taught, we're basically taught to create a situation where the person feels very trapped, they feel overwhelmed, they feel that no matter what they say, the detective is not going to believe them because they're told, I don't believe you, I know that you're guilty. And it creates this temporary but false perception that their best option to get out of that situation, to escape jail time, and to get that detective to help them is to tell the detective what they want to hear. It's, short-term benefits outweigh the long-term consequences.
And they can be pretty long-term consequences, like life in jail.
And that's what's amazing. But remember, we're telling the person, or we're conveying, maybe not directly, but indirectly and repeatedly over and over and over again, that, yeah, you're facing life in jail. You're facing the death penalty. The only way that you can escape that is by telling me what I know, what I already know as a detective is true, and I can help you. And that's the crux of the whole thing. That interrogation tactic can create good confessions because most of the time we have it right. We have the right person.
Right.
But the problem is I need you to tell me what I believe is true. And if I, as the detective, have it wrong, then, you got to figure out, okay, well, what does he want to know? And then I kind of tell you what I need you to say, and you create this narrative.
So you talked about the false confession. I think you're referring to the kidnapping and murder of Lawrence O'Connell, which was a case where you obtained a false confession. Is that correct? Can you describe a little bit more about that case?
Well, out of disrespect for the person who was arrested, I try to keep my conversation about that to a minimum because that's what they requested. But I can basically give you, the overall details.
Right.
This was a man who worked for the government. He left work. He disappeared. We were able to trace his credit card and ATM as it was used about the Washington, D.C. area. And he was found the next day beaten to death. We got ATM photographs of the person who was using the debit card. We got witnesses, and we got a lot of tips. As you can imagine, this was a very high-profile case.
Right.
So we got a lot of tips, and unfortunately, when investigations become what I call tip-driven, you start trying to match evidence to a person rather than trying to see if the evidence will take you to that person.
Right, right,
which is a great way to get tunnel vision into play.
So a tip might be somebody's name, and then you have maybe some photographic evidence that maybe isn't that clear and other things. Is that how it kind of works?
Sure. I mean, we tend to work backwards when we have tip evidence. We get the tip, and we work backwards with the evidence to see if we can make the evidence fit, rather than see if the evidence, you know, just like Sherlock Holmes said back in the 1880s, or I should say the fictional character Sherlock Holmes, right. You shouldn't theorize before you get evidence, because what you tend to do is you tend to shape the evidence to fit the theory rather than the other way around. And that's what happens in a lot of these cases. But in this case, we actually got a tip that we thought we had pretty good forensic evidence. We had a handwriting examiner who was saying that, yeah, this is a person who signed the credit card slip of the victim. Mm-hmm. So we arrested that person, charged him with credit card fraud, and over the course of several hours, they first admitted to the credit card fraud and then later admitted to the murder. Mm-hmm. And they gave us a lot of details that they should not have had if they were not there.
Right.
What happened was, at that time, my department's policy was that we did not videotape interrogations. We only videotaped the end result. But for various reasons that took way too long to go into, we videotaped a large part of the interrogation here.
Right.
Later on in our follow-up investigation, we stumbled across this person's alibi, which was unshakable. Mm-hmm. And then we went back and we re-examined the very foundation of our case, which was the handwriting analysis, and that turned out to be quite faulty. So they couldn't have done it. And so I wanted to find out what happened, and that's when I was going back and looking at the tape over and over and over again. And I realized, it wasn't right away, but I realized, look at the very subtle ways that we're giving this person little details, and look at the very how they're incorporating those details into the story. And it was like a game of 20 questions almost.
Right.
Because sometimes we would show her things, sometimes we would suggest things, sometimes she would guess, and she would guess a lot. And if the guess was close to being right, we would encourage it. If it wasn't right, we would say to ourselves, okay, she's being evasive. She's trying to minimize her involvement. She's trying to protect somebody. And after looking at God knows how many false confessions since then, that's a very common pattern. That's something that you just see over and over again. The detective who really believes that this person did it, they're not being malicious. They're not out there trying to get an innocent person to confess. They believe that they did it. They're wrapped up in this tunnel vision stuff. They use bad interrogation tactics. And then, not knowingly, because we're not trained in how not to do this.
The person is giving them information that matches, right? Not realizing they're just echoing back. Or I guess if the case was, say, a robbery of a liquor store and you said, I picked up the bottle of whiskey, and they say, are you sure it wasn't vodka? You kind of got a pretty good clue of what you're supposed to say.
Or even if it's something like, are you sure? That tells the person, I got it wrong. I better change.
Yes. White wine. Red wine. Yes. Another very famous case of false confessions was the Central Park Five, which had kind of been forgotten, but then Donald Trump apparently still believes these five people are guilty, so it's been in the news a little bit more. But can you describe a little bit about that, especially the false confession aspects of that case?
Well, sure. In that case, there was a young woman who was attacked and savagely beaten in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, there were some young men who were also in the park who were kind of roughhousing and doing some crazy things themselves. They came to the attention of the police fairly quickly, who snatched them up. And these were juveniles. These were young kids. Some had various intellectual disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the police interrogated them, and they were able to get them to come up with these narratives where they were the ones who attacked the women, attacked this one woman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in this case, just like with mine, the interrogations were not videotaped. It wasn't until the very end when they brought the prosecutor in. And actually, the five guys, some of them, if not all of them, were sitting there with their parents, and they would confess on tape to the prosecutor's question.
And again, you got five confessions in this case, right?
Right. But like I said, what will happen a lot of times, one of the evidence ploys that we use is we threaten people in very subtle ways or very overt ways. You know, bad things are going to happen. We have the evidence. We can lie about the evidence
mm-hmm.
that we have against them. We then tell them that, you know, look, if, especially with juveniles, a lot of times the hint is, look, just tell us what we wanted, what we need to hear. You can go home, that sort of thing. And so we get one confession, then we go to the other guy and we say, hey, you're done because your buddy just gave it up. He's putting it on you. Get him to confess. And it's like a domino effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, what happened was it was quite some time later that this other suspect came to light. It turned out that it was his DNA. And what's interesting is, you know, when you get these false confessions, like these young men, a lot of times they contain these details that are true and do match the crime scene, but then they contain all this wild and crazy stuff that doesn't match anything at all and doesn't match the other confessions. And we don't look upon this as a red flag. That happened in my case. This woman mm-hmm. confessed to some things that we're going, you know, that ain't quite right, but she got this right. And so we become
right.
very selective in how we look at stuff. And like I said, we explain it away. They're just trying to minimize their own involvement. You know, they're trying to hide something. But
right.
they said that they did it, and these are the details.
Right. Just...
And that's what's... And so, like I said, this other man, he was located. He had been doing, you know, robberies, rapes, I should say, attacks on women. It was his DNA. It was only his DNA. It wasn't the DNA of anybody else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, like I said, you see the power of a confession. Here's this man saying, you know, I still believe. Well, one thing is he already committed himself a long time ago. And Mr. Trump does not like to say that he's wrong with anything.
Okay,
as many of us do, to be honest with you. And so we have a hard time being able to say, well, maybe I want to look at it from a different light.
yeah. Well, I guess we don't want to investigate the psychology of Donald Trump too much.
Well, that psychology, unfortunately, is in all of us.
Yes.
To some degree.
Well, I think I can remember when that news came out, and of course it was a horrible, brutal rape. The woman was not killed, right? But she was beaten savagely, right? Like, and
yeah,
I think they thought she might die. It was so bad.
But she did not remember anything.
Right.
So.
Right. But I mean, that was, and of course it was five black guys, right, and a white woman jogging in Central Park. So there was that sort of racial aspect to it, which
and that's where this whole concept of wilding came out.
Mm.
And you know, these packs of youth roaming the city attacking people, I mean, that myth kind of started there.
Oh.
And it took off in the media.
Well, yeah, it's nothing like starting a good story with a completely false story.
Well, we do it all the time, so
yes. I mean, I guess maybe it's not that long. I mean, there's where police used to beat confessions out of people, and these newer techniques where you'd just be talking to somebody seemed like a major advance in policing and a reduction in brutality.
Yes, in fact, that's how these interrogation tactics came to be. You know, back in the 30s and before that, the third degree was just just an accepted part of law enforcement. It's funny because there's all these articles from the news back then where all these police, because the judges were starting to throw out confessions and the lawmakers were starting to say, well, maybe cops shouldn't beat people. And all these police chiefs were saying, well, we don't beat people, but if you don't let us beat people, we'll never solve crime. The same thing happens over and over again, like Miranda. You know, okay, now we got to read people their rights. Right. Oh, my God, you know, this is the end of the world. We'll never get another confession. And, of course, that's not true.
Yes.
And now that people are looking at the interrogation tactics that we have been taught to use for the last 40 years and say, well, maybe this isn't a good idea, the cry is out there again. Oh, my God, we'll never be able to get another confession. But to go back to your original question, that's the one bad thing about old homicide detectives. We tend to ramble. Back in the 40s, this new technique came out that's been now commonly known as the Reed technique, and it was a major advancement at the time.
Right.
Because you know, what they were saying is by using these psychological principles and all of that, you're able to convince the person to confess without beating them. And where the Reed technique has kind of been, and it works. It's very, very successful. It does work. But what the Reed technique has never really been able to come to terms with is the fact that it does promote tunnel vision in the investigators, and it can contribute to false confessions. They still deny that to this day.
I mean, it seems like it's pretty obvious. I mean, in your case, there was a cast iron alibi. So the only real explanation of what happened is that it was a false confession. It's hard to see something else. Similar to the Central Park Five, they found another culprit with forensic evidence. Unless you want to believe six people beat the woman and only one left DNA on the woman, it's pretty hard not to accept that it was a five false confessions.
Right. And the thing about, you know, Reed, like I said, Reed was a revelation in his day. And for decades, they would say that if you use our technique properly, you'll never get a false confession, even though their very founder got a false confession himself back in the 1950s, I believe. But for decades, their primary focus was on admissibility. They want to be able to get a confession that's admissible in court. But there's a trilogy here that's this three-prong test. Mm-hmm. It has to be admissible, it has to be accurate, and it has to be reliable. And you can have a confession that's admissible, but totally not reliable.
What do you mean by not reliable?
Well, the thing is, the courts are pretty liberal. I shouldn't say liberal, because that's kind of like the wrong term to use here. But in the U.S., especially with Miranda, one of the bad things that Miranda has done is, even though cops are afraid of it, most people are going to waive it anyway. And once you get a person to say, yes, I agree to talk to you without an attorney present, all they got to do is say yes. It doesn't mean they don't have to understand it. They don't have to comprehend it. There's no rule that says I have to make sure that they understand what they're doing. I just have to read them this form, and they just got to check the box. Once they do that, most judges will let you run wild. As one attorney said, in their jurisdiction, you can almost put pins under the person's fingernail, and they're still going to get it in because the judge is going to say, well, they waived Miranda. And of course, judges and the public have come to expect us, because of TV and all that, to use these extremely coercive interrogation techniques. But when I talk about reliability, it's admissible what I do to get you to make a confession. But is that confession actually real? And that's where law enforcement falls flat, because what we'll do is we'll go in there, we'll contaminate the confession, and then we won't go out and take what I call the fourth step of, you know, making sure of a bad confession. They don't let you corroborate the details that the person gives.
Right. You talked about that, about going, like, if somebody says the body, you know, is by the side of the river or wherever, and you go out there and there's a body there, well, that's pretty good evidence,
that's
right?
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because so many times, like in my case, the person gave a lot of details that, like I said, we went out to try to corroborate them and we found evidence to the contrary. A lot of times law enforcement won't do that. You have to be able to show that the details that they give fit the crime scene, but were provided by them and not by you.
Right, right.
And then you have to, what's really great is if they give information that you didn't know, like the location of the gun, that sort of thing.
Right.
It's really funny when it comes to corroboration, it's so funny because cops think that they're the most cynical people on the face of the earth, and we are the biggest suckers. Especially if somebody's telling us something that we want to hear. Oftentimes, I would get into arguments with my coworkers about whether or not a confession is reliable. Mm-hmm. And I would tell them, I said, wait a minute. If this person who just confessed this crime to you, if this person walked in and they said, I am a witness to a crime, and this is what I saw. Based on what you as the detective know about the crime scene and the evidence, you would kick that person out on their ear.
Right.
Because none of what they're saying matches the evidence that you know to be true. However, because somebody said, I did it, and this is what I did, oh my God, suddenly, you know, that skepticism goes out the window, and they embrace them, you know, wholeheartedly. And I'm going, that's not the way it works. You're supposed to be skeptical of witness statements, victim statements, and confession, which kind of leads me into something else, if I could kind of take over the interview for one second.
You're doing a good job. You can take my job after this.
But one of the things that I like to point out is that, you know, false confessions are a problem. Mm-hmm. We know they're a problem. There's enough confirmed cases of false confessions where the person wasn't a juvenile, where the person wasn't mentally ill. The person was like you and me. However, the bigger problem is that if we have a witness or we have a victim who, or a informant, let's say, who we don't think is telling us the truth, we're taught to go into interrogation mode. We're taught to use these same tactics that could potentially produce a false confession on these people. And during that time, many times, we unintentionally contaminate what the victim and the witness is to make it correspond to what we think they should know.
Oh, okay. So you might sort of feed the victim evidence about your suspect, about
right.
their skin color, what they're wearing, things like that. And then the victim now knows things that maybe the victim didn't know, maybe that are not correct.
Or like witnesses. You know, we know the basics of contamination. We know that you should separate witnesses at a crime scene so that they can't talk to each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But what we do a lot of times is we'll put them in separate rooms. I'll go in and interview one person. I'll get the details from them of what they saw or thought they saw. I'll then go talk to my partner who's interviewing the other person. They say something different, and I'll go in there and say, hey, well, this guy over here is saying this. How come you're lying to us? And so I actually do the cross-contamination myself
rather than let
the witnesses do it. There's also what I call post-confession contamination, where somebody will go out, the detective will go out and tell a witness or tell a victim that, hey, yeah, the guy confessed, but he's saying this. Is this true? And the victim or the witness may be going, well, he confessed, so he must have done it. Maybe I didn't remember that part.
Right.
Or they need me to say this to help the prosecution, and he's already confessed anyway, so yeah.
I mean,
it
is a problem that if say something simple like a traffic accident, if you have three or four witnesses, some of them will provide information that could not be true, right? Or at least that they will provide information that contradicts each other. So, you know, that you might not know which is true, but they can't all be true.
Right. And that's the whole thing. You get things like that in every single statement, good and bad. But you kind of want to be, you know, critical and analyze it. Like if you, let's say that you have a guy who's confessing to a burglary. or a burglary, and you ask him, okay, what did you do with the stolen property? And he says he hid it somewhere. You went and you looked, and it's not there. Well, he may not want to tell you what he did with the stolen property, that he sold it to this fence, because you're going to be able to tie him to a bunch of other burglaries. But if somebody, and the example that I use is, it's a little extreme, but if somebody is a suspect in the murder of a child, and that's all that they did was murder the child, or that they're suspected of doing, but they're confessing to murdering and sexually abusing the child, and there's no evidence of that whatsoever, you want to go, wait a minute, why are they adding this extra information that increases their criminal culpability? There's something going on here. It doesn't automatically mean that their confession is false, but it's a red flag that law enforcement needs to think about and analyze. Also,
Go ahead.
But also, a lot of times, details are left out, and you kind of have to wonder, okay, were those details left out because they don't want to tell me, or because they weren't provided by the investigator during the interview? A great case of this is the case of Marty Tankless up in New York, who is at 17 years old. He wakes up, and he finds that his mother's been murdered, and his father's close to death because he had a throat cut and he was beat. The first investigator gets on the scene, automatically determines that Marty's a suspect because he was quote unquote acting inappropriately.
What's the appropriate way to act after your parents were killed?
Thank you. And just as a side note, the very first step to getting a false confession is identifying the wrong person as a suspect. And we do that all sorts of ways. And doing stuff like that, oh, he's acting inappropriately, so he must have done it, going on your gut instinct, that's a major way of doing it. Well, so they take Marty in to the police station. The detective does like a 20-minute walkthrough of the crime scene. He sees certain things during that 20 minutes. He goes back. They use some pretty bad trickery to get Marty to think that he may have done it. They lie to him about some of the evidence they saw. They lie to him about certain scientific tests that they supposedly did. And the most outrageous thing was they told Marty, the 17-year-old kid in shock for finding his parents dead, they told him, well, because your father was at the hospital. He was alive at the hospital still. And they gave him a shot of adrenaline, and he woke up and he said that you did it. And Marty's going, my father would never lie.
Right.
Oh, my God, maybe I blacked out or something.
Right.
And Marty starts to give a confession. The interesting part about the confession, it contains only the details that the detective saw in his conclusions that he came to during that 20 minutes that he was on the crime scene. All the extra stuff that was found afterwards was not included in the confession.
And in that case, did they find another suspect? Like, how did they eventually eliminate?
There was another suspect who was just blatantly obvious. In fact, he fled. He faked his own death. He fled the area, faked his own death. But the cops were so fixated on Marty, they disregarded that. Marty was convicted, spent several years in jail. But he was exonerated. Because of the work of his attorneys and other investigators that kind of pointed more to this other guy, and also the fact that Marty's confession was just total bull. In fact, Marty's been out for a while. He just passed the New York bar exam. He's now an attorney.
Really? So he's going to be a lawyer with a pretty good understanding of
yes.
of these issues. Well,
absolutely.
I mean, that's nice to know. I not to get too much into, I don't know what your feelings are on the death penalty, but I hear about these cases, and I think that some of these people could have been executed, whereas if there's a travesty of justice, if they are put in jail for life, at some point you can let them out, and some people can go on to live a productive life after being convicted of murder or something.
Sure, many become advocates. But of course, I have no doubt that this follows you for the rest of your life. And when it comes to the death penalty, I mean, there are just so many ways that we can make mistakes. I don't know for sure, but I'm probably one of the few cops who is anti-death penalty for that reason, because I just see too many ways that investigations can get off track and too many ways that mistakes can be made to want to, you know, go that ultimate, you know, we are so sure that we're going to put this guy to death. So.
Yeah. I mean, like in the recent executions in Alabama, I mean, it seems like some of them definitely did it, but I think some of them may be false convictions as well. And even the cases where they obviously did it, they often are based on there was a confession that
right.
they did it.
Well, in this one case in Virginia just recently, he was due to be executed 3 days ago, and the governor gave him life in prison instead at the last minute. But
right.
this was a young man named Ivan Teteligus, mm-hmm. and I actually worked on the case. And this is a case where maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. But the allegation was that he hired this man to travel down a couple hundred miles to kill his ex-wife, his baby's child for him.
Right.
But that was the police's, that was the cop's theory. They first thought he did it,
right.
but he had an alibi, and it wasn't his DNA on the scene because
mm-hmm.
the perpetrator cut himself.
Right.
So he was ruled out. But when they did find the true perpetrator, whose blood that they were pretty sure it was going to match, this is the way that they approached him during their interview. They went to him. They said, look, we're going to take your DNA. If it matches, which he knew that it was going to match, we are going to seek the death penalty for you. This prosecutor is going to do everything that she can to make sure that you get the death penalty.
Right.
The only way that you can escape the death penalty is by cooperating with us and telling us that Ivan hired you to kill this woman.
Wow.
And then they got the prosecutor on the phone who said, yes, I am going to seek the death penalty for you. And if you cooperate, and by cooperating, I mean you must testify that Ivan hired you to do this.
Really?
I mean, yes.
That's brutal. So the guy who we know, actually did the murder, escapes the death penalty, but at the price of somebody we know didn't do the murder but maybe planned it, get the death penalty.
His comment to the detective and the prosecutor was, do you mean that you want this guy so bad that you would give somebody who deserves the death penalty a break? And they said, yes. And he goes, okay, no problem.
And why did they want Ivan so badly? Why did they want him?
Because they were convinced, even, you know, they in their own mind were convinced that he had some participation in this. And they fell into the trap of a very bad investigative trap where we are not seeking information. We're not seeking facts. We're not following the evidence. We've already come up with that theory, so we're seeking confirmation.
Right, we're going to confirm our theory. I mean, did they ever get evidence that these two men had met at any time? Was there any evidence for that?
There was some kind of, I forget all the details because there was a lot of them. Actually, they got one other person to confess, say Ivan did it. They got a jailhouse informant, which is a whole nother
problematic
issue.
Yes.
Right. Since then, all three have recanted their statements to your prosecutors and in the court and say that, no, you know, Ivan didn't do it. The one that I was talking about,
right,
he had recanted, and they were going to bring him in for a hearing to testify before a judge to get Ivan off.
Right.
And at the last minute, the prosecutor met with them, and the prosecutor said, just like I told you, if you renege on your deal, then I will go back and I will seek the death penalty for you. So he decided not to testify.
Which is
understandable. But that's the power that prosecutors have, especially with guilty pleas and things like that. They can they can actually use all these threats and mean it to get people to plead guilty, to get people to testify against others. When it comes to coercive interrogation techniques and getting witnesses to change their stories and all of that, and even contamination, you know, prosecutors are actually in a much better position to create false witness evidence and false confessions in the form of false guilty pleas.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't give us what we want, you're going to get the death penalty, or you're going to get 100 years in jail. That you don't need a big stick or to stick a gun on somebody's the side of somebody's head. That's a pretty big stick. Just quietly saying, this is what we're going to do if you don't give us what we want.
Sure, and that's the problem with guilty pleas a lot of times, because you know people are stuck in jail. Especially, we always look at false confessions on big cases, but that's typically because we only have limited resources, and you know, we can only devote them to like these cases where people are facing the death penalty of life in prison. But people, you know, do false guilty pleas all the time, and they give false confessions in minor cases or false statements in minor cases, but there's just, you know, nobody out there who is able to kind of look at this stuff and help them out. I mean, if I'm sitting in jail for, you know, 30 days waiting for my trial, and I'm being held without bond, and I'm told, well, if you plead guilty, you can get out tomorrow, and, you know, I've already lost, or I'm going to lose my apartment, my job, and all this, it becomes a business arrangement. It's not
right
that they're actually considering, okay, I really did it, and I'm going to do it, you know, confess because I really did it. They're pleading because, oh my God, I got to take care of all this other stuff.
Right.
It's the lesser of two evils.
My previous guest was John Raefling of the Human Rights Watch, who was talking about bail reform in California.
Oh,
and he made this he made this point that if you don't get bail and you're in jail, your aim is like, what's the quickest way? And if you're told, well, if you plead guilty, we'll give you 10 years, and if you don't plead guilty, we're going to go for life, then, you know, there's a big chance you're going to plead guilty, which I guess is essentially the same as confessing, right? You're going to say
it is. It's the same thing. You're saying to the judge that you did a crime that you didn't do.
Right. I mean, you don't even have to have a confession. If you plead guilty, nobody's going to ask any more questions. You mentioned one thing, which was pretty interesting, was lying about the evidence, and that's okay. So that I could come in as a police detective and say, we found your DNA on the scene, or something like that, when we know that's not true. Is that valid for a policeman to do that?
Yes. And in fact, it's something that law enforcement has, you know, has fought to preserve, and also the leading interrogation schools. We're allowed to lie up to a certain point. We can't lie and say, look, if you confess, the judge is going to, you know, drop the charges or stuff like that. But we can say, yeah, we got three witnesses who saw you going around back with your buddy. We thought, you know, we got all these people who identified you from photo spreads, and they don't know you from Adam. But they were able to pick your picture out of a photo spread of six other people. How could they have done that if you weren't there?
Right.
It's funny because, you know, like I talked about the Reed people, the Reed School.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in the last several decades, they've become much more active. They finally admitted that false confessions are possible, but not if you use their technique. So they have a lot of stuff in their textbooks and on their website about false confessions. However, they never teach it in class. That's a whole other topic we could talk about. But they still say that they strongly support, even though most of your false confession cases, you'll see that there was some sort of what we call false evidence ploy used to get that false confession. What the Reed people say is that simply introducing false evidence into an interrogation will not produce a false confession. And I agree with them, because if I just walked in there and said, hey, I got your fingerprints on the gun, or hey, I got three witnesses who said you did the crime, and nothing else, you're not going to confess. There's no reason for you to. But if I go in there and I use, you know, threats of inevitable consequences, you know, like, you know, we know you did it, you can't say anything to us that's going to change our mind. You know, we got all these witnesses who saw that you did it. But if you confess and say that you didn't do it, we can get you help. They say that that is inappropriate and that that can lead to false confessions. But that's what an interrogation consists of. You don't use these techniques in isolation. You use them together, and you use them over and over and over again, and without letting the person get a word in edgewise. So Reed has a lot of fine print in their textbooks. But he doesn't make a lot of sense.
Another thing I've addressed in a couple of previous shows is shaken baby syndrome. And here, mm-hmm. I think an issue is that the choice is not who did it, but it could be, was this a case of murder, or was it an undiagnosed genetic or congenital condition, or was it an adverse reaction to some medical treatment? So the alternative is nobody is guilty because it's natural causes, versus the caregiver shook the baby. I mean, do you think police would sort of prefer to have a guilty party than to go back and say, well, nobody did it?
Well, it's not that they would prefer, because like I said, they are really typically acting off of the information that they have or that they believe that they have. And there's two factors that are in play here. One, investigations are always messy things. Detectives come in, they get incomplete information. Sometimes it's inaccurate. They're trying to make decisions based on that incomplete and accurate, and often that's the inaccurate information, and sometimes they get it wrong. Second, we're always in a hurry. We're trying to close cases quickly. There's mm-hmm. pressure on us to close these cases, and confessions are an easy and lazy cop's way to close cases. So I, as the detective, show up at the... In fact, this happened to me. In one case that I had, I got a call for a dead child in the emergency room, and I get there, and the child is nothing but skin and bones. And there were signs that it appeared to have been sexually abused. And the medical personnel at the hospital were going, oh, my God, this is the worst case of child abuse we've ever seen. Look at this sexual abuse. It's obvious. The anal cavity was really expanded on the child. So the parents had such cognitive disabilities that they would have confessed to anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I could have gone in there and gotten a confession to all sorts of stuff at that time. Instead, what I did was I called in from our medical examiner's office, a specialist in child death and child autopsies, who said, oh, no, this isn't child abuse. This is typical of the medical condition that this child has because the child can't digest food. And also the food builds up in the child's system. And when it does come out, it comes out
in hard lumps.
Form that it charges the rectum to enlarge.
But
think what happens a lot of times with like shaken baby, it might be a misdiagnosis. The detective goes into the interview room with the mother who's been the sole caretaker for the last 24 hours saying, look, we have scientific evidence. Now, they think they do, but if they don't, it's the same thing as lying, but they just don't know that they're lying.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of cases where there are doctors who basically provide that false evidence by saying this is child abuse, and then maybe another expert will come along and say no. Like in your case, this is a natural causes death. But if the first doctor who gets there, who probably works with the police a lot, says this is child abuse, then the detective naturally is going to follow that line, I guess. It makes sense.
Sure. And we want to get it closed quickly. It could be figured, okay, if we wait, she'll get an attorney, so we got to do this now. So they tell the mother, we have scientific evidence, if you want to help your child, or if you don't want your other children to be taken away from you right now, we got to figure out what happened. And the doctor says, somebody has to have shook that baby. And so mom goes, God, I got to help my child. I got to protect my other children. They're saying that this happened. Well, maybe I laid my child down too hard. And
Well, or maybe the mother, maybe the mother did shake the baby, because that's a natural reaction. If a baby is not moving, you pick the baby up and shake it because you want to get life, right? But you're not shaking it that hard, and there's no way you could have caused that damage. But of course, that becomes magnified in your head during the
I'm going to use your example from now on. Your example is much better than mine.
No, and I mean, this is something I've learned from people who've dealt with shaken baby syndrome cases is you almost always do that. I can remember from my own children, like if your child doesn't appear to be breathing in bed, which I've seen several times, they're sleeping so deeply that you're not sure they're breathing,
right.
So you kind of push them a little bit. If you didn't get anything, you might shake them, and when they start crying, you go, oh my God, I'm glad my child's okay.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of time left, but can you describe the PEACE method, which you've been advocating?
Sure. Well, what happened was back several decades ago in the UK, they had a rash of wrongful convictions that were based on false confessions.
Mm-hmm.
So what they decided to do was to study the problem. They told their people to start audio taping interrogations. They studied it. They realized that they were using these Reed-style techniques, and they told them to stop. They then developed a system that was actually based on science, on the way that we remember things, the way that we communicate, and they call it PEACE as an acronym. And I often joke that if we're going to adopt it here, then we're going to have to change the name, because cops here want task force, you know, whatever like that. They want something much more masculine. But it's a much more intelligent way to approach an investigation. And basically what they do is they say everything that you do and read is outlawed. In fact, it's considered to be a human rights violation over in the UK. You can't threaten people, even implied threats. You can't lie to them, and you can't offer them anything. But what you do is you go into the interview looking for information, not mm-hmm. for a confession. So you get the person to do most of the talking, and you're taught the way to do this is to be able to extract all this great detail from the person so that they kind of lock themselves in to whatever account, whatever alibi they have, and then you confront them with the evidence. Let's say an example that I use is, let's say that you're my suspect because we have a picture from a red light camera of your car one block away from the crime scene, five minutes after the shooting, or 2 minutes after the shooting.
Right, right.
Well, I think in the U.S., what I would do is I would bring you in, and I would say, were you there? You would say no, and I say, you're lying. Boom, there's a picture of your car.
Right.
And what might you say? You might say, people borrow my car all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm stuck at that point. But what I do with PEACE is I think about all the alternative reasons why you might not have been in that car. During the interview, I'm asking you, okay, you told me where you went that day, you told me your route, you told me everybody you saw, but you were at home that night. But you drove a car. What type of car do you have? Who else has keys to your car? Does anybody borrow your car? Nobody.
Mm.
And so you explore all these areas. Now, during that explanation, you might say, well, yeah, my brother borrows it every so often. Well, now I realize that you have a brother who I need to look at as well.
Yeah, could potentially be a suspect, right?
Right. So where using the Reed technique, I would probably not find that out because I'm doing all the talking. Here, I would lock you into whatever, and then at the very end, could you explain to me, please, how we have a picture of your car one block from the crime scene? Now you're stuck.
Right, and that's real evidence. It's not like saying, we have a picture of you in your car outside the liquor store where there was the robbery, when you actually don't.
Right.
You actually
absolutely.
Do have evidence.
And even if you shut down, even if you say, I don't want to talk anymore, I have all that other information that I got beforehand that I can now go out and disprove your alibi. And you'll sometimes hear cops say that a lie can be as good as a confession. But you have to be able to develop that lie. You have to be able to go and show, no, he wasn't here. he didn't go to the store because the video cameras in the store did not capture him, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing about peace is they treat people who are going through peace like they're professionals. It's not like a 2 or 3 day class where you sit there and watch videos and then suddenly you're certified as an interrogator.
Right.
They spend weeks on this stuff throughout their career. They're taught about false confessions. They're taught about how memory works, about contamination. They're taught about how tunnel vision can impact investigations. Mm-hmm. And they're evaluated all the time. So that's the biggest thing. I walk out of a peace training, I go do interviews, and I have better trained peace people come behind me and make sure that I'm doing it properly.
Right, with an awareness that if I don't do this right, I could end up putting an innocent person in jail.
Sure, or even what happens more is when you do it wrong, you might put an innocent person in jail, but you might screw up and a guilty person walks free.
Right, right. I'm getting, that's the other side of it often, isn't it?
Right.
Right. Yes.
Well, the thing is, if you have a real suspect in your interrogation room and they give you a confession, if you contaminated that confession so badly before they gave it to you, a good defense attorney is going to come behind you and say, oh, he told my client everything to say. How can you tell that he was really there? You have
right.
no other witnesses. You only have his word. But everything he said first came out of the detective's mouth.
Right, right. And then by this time, maybe a year or two has gone by, and the guilty party has, maybe will never be brought to justice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've pretty much run out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our discussion?
The only thing I want to say is that people who say that they don't understand why people would falsely confess because they would never do it, I always like to bring up, well, why would somebody confess to a crime that they did do?
Yeah.
Both are very stupid things.
Yeah,
they're both very
true.
Dumb things. They're both
right.
against your best interest. So the dynamics for both are there. And lastly, yes, given the right circumstances, any one of us will confess to a crime that we didn't do.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining me. And I'd like to remind my audience that the book is called How the Police Generate False Confessions. And if you want to learn more about the subject, I recommend that you read it. Thanks for joining me today, Jim.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 140 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. You can commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.